DJ discourse, eclecticism versus purity, the lost world of smoking cigarettes on the dance floor. These are just some of the things that you're about to hear over the next hours. We're going to be doing a deep dive into the last 20 years of underground electronic music culture with someone who's sidestepped their way ahead through this era. There is a pun in there somewhere. But first, Lost and Sound is sponsored by Audio Technica. Audio Technica are a global but still family-run company that make headphones, turntables, cartridges, microphones. They make studio quality, yet really affordable products because they believe that high-quality audio should be accessible to all. So wherever you are in the world, head on over to audiotechnica.com to check out all of their range of stuff. Welcome to Lost and Sound. I'm Paul Hamford. I'm your host. I'm a writer, author, a university lecturer, a former DJ based in Berlin, where I'm speaking to you now from. And this is the show where each episode I have conversations with the musical innovators, the outsiders, the mavericks, the artists that do their own unique thing. And we talk about music, we talk about life, we talk about creativity, basically the things that inspire us to make the things that we make. Previous guests on the show have included Peaches, Suzanne Ciani, Jim O'Rourke, Chili Gonzalez, Ghost Poet, Cozy Funny Tutti, Graham Coxon, Sleaford Mods, Mickey Blanco, and Thurston Moore. And today on the show, you're going to hear a conversation I had with DJ, producer, label owner, club promoter, and more recently a podcaster himself, Scuba. My book, Coming to Berlin, is available in all good bookshops. And I really mean that, all good bookshops. If a bookshop doesn't have it, that bookshop is fucking shit. Or via the publisher's website, Velocity Press. Okay, so I apologize about my delivery today. I'm a little bit under the weather. I've had a bit of a sick week this week, but I'm picking up and I'm really happy to be able to put out this conversation I had about a week ago with Scuba. Paul Rose is Scuba's real name. Over the last 20 years, he's been someone that's really helped shape and define the definition, the direction of bass-heavy electronic music, emerging originally out of London's underground garage scene as it sort of morphed into dubstep. As a DJ, but also with his imprint label Hot Flush, which has over the years helped launch the careers of people like Mount Kimby, Joy Orbison, the list goes on. He's made 5 artist albums as Scuba to date. And they're albums that I'd sort of describe them as being like diaries, sonic diaries of where he's at that time. So they always evolve. They always sort of confound expectations and push boundaries. And this began in 2008 with his album A Mutual Antipathy, which we talk a little bit about in the podcast, which he made after he moved to Berlin. And it's melancholic. It's after coming out of the London club scene. It's full of huge swathes of atmosphere. It's an album that could be described as being dark and depressing, but maybe that's just kind of really what I like myself. And it does, to me, sound like Berlin. He also, in his time in this city, set up a dubstep night that ran for 5 years at Berghain. He's crafted mixes for DJ Kicks, for Fabric, and Oscar... I always say that wrong. Oscar Totten, fucking hell, mate. I'm still not totally with it, I can tell you that. Apologies about my delivery today. He also won DJ Mag Best Live Act Award in 2013. He's got a new mix tape coming out, Digital Underground, which is out on the 10th of November, which, if you're listening to the podcast, this podcast, the week it comes out, is Friday. And it's a super fun listen. It feels like, you know, kind of equating the same artist that made A Mutual Antipathy to the Digital Underground mixtape is like a dots to dots of like how an artist really works on what their guts tell them to do and what they feel. The underground is a fun kind of collage of old school hardcore, of little bits of two-step, of like old rave, but slightly modernized, given a twist. It's fun. It's a really, really, really fun record. He's also a podcaster, I might have mentioned as well. His show, Not a Diving Podcast, is one of the best music podcasts around. He really knows how to get deep and talk with guests. I was a guest on his show about a month ago. I'll put a link to that in the hyper description-y type thing on the podcasty blurby stuff. And I really, really enjoyed him talking to me. So it was really interesting to sort of like swap chairs, really, and to ask Scuba some questions. And he's a really thoughtful, insightful bloke. He has a lot of opinions, but they're informed, intelligent opinions about DJ discourse, about culture. And this is what happened when I caught up with Paul Rose, aka Scuba. Thanks so much for chatting with me today. How are things? How are you doing? You good?
Yes. Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
No worries. It's it's quite rare that I actually speak to another Paul, actually. I don't know if you found that in your experiences. I don't know many Pauls. There's lots of like Toms and stuff, but not many Pauls.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know why that is. Lack of pious parents, maybe, around that kind of a time.
Maybe there's just lots of pools in other fields like banking, and we're kind of outliers to the pool name. I don't know,
that's also a possibility too. Yeah.
I mean, you're over the 20 or so years of, you know, being very visible doing what you're doing as Scuba, you've been a DJ, a producer, a label owner, a club promoter, and a podcaster too. Although these things haven't all concurred exactly at the same time, how do you manage to split your time up? How do you manage to sort of jump from these different things? Is it quite an effort, or does it feel very effortless for you to flow between these different things?
Well, doing the podcast every week has definitely added an extra layer of intensity to the whole thing. I mean, as you know, in of itself, it's a pretty big commitment. But I guess like anything, you kind of get used to the ebb and flow of it, and you kind of get into a routine. And, you know, I think at any given time, and this has been true at any point in the last couple of decades, there's one area that's being neglected, you know. So I kind of like rotate the thing that I'm not paying as much attention to as I should be. So I don't know. I mean, it's kind of it's a challenge for sure, keeping as many plates in the air as I am want to do. But in terms of like just keeping myself motivated and interested and excited about what I'm doing on a kind of day to day basis, it's important for me, you know. And I think the fact that I do still enjoy the whole thing, I am still kind of like plugging away after what is quite a long time now, I guess suggests that something is going right at some level anyway.
Yeah, and I love what you're saying about it being important to you. So it's not like, because I feel like a lot of the time, particularly like younger artists, sort of feel that they have to do this. They have to do this, you know, promote themselves on the socials, really stretch themselves. But there's also that kind of creative way of looking at it, that if, you know, if you're a kind of music curator and you know, you live in music, that you do want to express yourself in different ways. Has it always been the case for you that there's just different outlets for different forms of expression?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think what you're referring to is, it's a big change, I think, in what is expected of people. I think particularly in quote unquote underground music, you know, there is a real expectation that you sell yourself now in a way which was actually kind of seen as being, you know, a bit lame actually, you know, in days gone by. But I mean, I think I always thought that was a bit of a ridiculous way of looking at it, though. I always thought that, you know, it's incumbent upon you to get yourself out there. And, you know, like, I think the idea that you can wait around for it to happen in this kind of like mythical bedroom producer kind of a way, I think that was always bullshit. But I think perhaps now the pressures of, you know, I think it's gone swung back too far. You know, I think the expectation upon people to spend so much of their time doing the selling versus the making, I think is pretty unhealthy, actually. So I haven't answered your question. What was your actual question? Because I got distracted by
just please just go on the flow of it. That's what it's about. I mean, I think I was kind of asking you about how you managed to jump between different things. And was that always like kind of quite important for you to express yourself through all of these different platforms and media?
I mean, to be honest, yes, I suppose in hindsight, but I think the way that it's developed over time has been much more kind of accidental and much more haphazard. So, you know, you kind of acquire things along the way. And then if you're, you know, I suppose if you're enjoying them enough to carry on doing them, then yeah, that's a good sign. But I think that you know, it's a question of being consistent, I think, with everything. And I think that's what gives you longevity in doing anything, to be honest. So it's a question of like acquiring things, keeping them going, making them good, but being persistent, you know, and not losing heart when things don't immediately go the way you want them to. And, you know, when you take that approach, when it does eventually work, then, you know, that's a really great feeling, you know. So that in itself, wanting to replicate that can become a motivating factor as you kind of like get further down the road. So, I mean, it's a difficult thing to recommend, you know, taking on loads and loads of stuff and having too much to do at all times. I mean, it's not necessarily something that I would say to, you know, a young person starting out, this is the way to do it. I'm not completely sure that it is, but, you know, I think, well, like anything in life, you've got to find a way that works for you, you know, personally. And for whatever reason, this approach seems to have worked for me over time.
Yeah. And I think like you mentioned about consistency, and that's very much a key thing. There are times when we just don't feel like we're being consistent, though, as well, aren't there? There are times where you just have to step away. And have there been times in your career where you've kind of felt, you know, I just can't do this right now at the moment. You know, I need to just step away and fuck consistency.
Well, I suppose that is the bonus, or that is the you know, the positive of having so many things that you could be doing. Because, and like I said, like at any given moment, there is one of the things that I should be doing, which is not receiving as much attention, you know? And so when you do get pissed off with something, there's always something else to be doing, you know? So, which is not necessarily, again, massively healthy way of conducting your working life. But, you know, I mean, I've had a couple of periods where the whole thing got too much, which I suppose maybe is more what you were getting at. And I think that's just part of life, though, isn't it, really? I think it's just inevitable that there are moments at which you begin to feel overwhelmed by, you know, by life, I suppose. And, you know, I guess that's one thing that's being, I guess, working for yourself and being in this kind of working structure, like it does bleed into your personal life. It becomes your whole life, basically, which is just not the case when, you know, if you're working 9 to 5, which I have done, which I did do for a few years before I was able to go pro, as it were. And it is all encompassing, and that in itself can become a kind of reinforcing thing too. So, I mean, yeah, it can be difficult. And I have, like I said, had a couple of periods where it did go a bit too much, but, you know, at the end of the day, I would rather be doing this than doing anything else. And sometimes you need to step back and get reaffirm that to yourself. But I mean, hopefully that doesn't happen too often, right?
Yeah, and definitely I find that sometimes
those times you need to step back, that's when perhaps you've been in a groove of doing, focusing in one way for a while, and maybe things have changed a bit on the outside or also with you, and taking a step back helps you kind of recalibrate as well. Have you found times, because, you know, you're such an eclectic artist as well, and, you know, you've jumped through different styles, but they've always sounded like your productions. Has that been like kind of beneficial to you to sort of take a step back for that reason?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, certainly using that example of making music is, that's absolutely, yeah, on the money. I find that a change is as good as a rest a lot of the time in that kind of way. And I think that probably explains, like you say, I've jumped around so much stylistically over the years. And I just enjoy messing about and doing different stuff, though, to be honest. And it is inspiring. It is motivating, you know? Like, you do get into a kind of repetitive cycle after a while. That can be a positive, though, you know, that's a result of hitting something which works, or it can be anyway. It should be. And when you do hit something that works, then yeah, absolutely milk it for as much as can be milked from that. But like anything, you know, there's a finite amount that can be got out of anything, you know? So, and at that point you have to, you know, have to do something else, have to step back, just find a way of regaining a bit of focus, regaining a bit of perspective, as you were saying. That process in of itself can be the best bit, I guess.
And, you know, on that note, next week, which will be the week that people will be listening to this podcast, you've got a mixtape, Digital Underground, coming out. And it seems to be like this really, you know, comparing it to your albums as Scuba, or a lot of your other stuff, it feels like very, very rammed full. You know, a lot of your other work, you know, there's all about the kind of minimalism and the space between sounds, whereas Digital Underground, there's a lot of like early hardcore, there's a lot of breaks and techno. It feels like there's a lot of formative influences going on there. Can you tell me a little bit about how this project came together?
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, it's a great example of that previous thing that we just touched upon, right? So I guess, well, I think it started off as quite a self-indulgent project, to be honest. Like, just sitting down every morning and writing a hardcore track, an old school hardcore track, which was just hugely enjoyable to me.
I can imagine. Right,
because it's, you know, it's so much fun, that music, anyway. And then it's so much fun trying to figure out, kind of reverse engineer how they did it, and, like, you know, try and put a little bit of a fresh spin on it. And, you know, you're not inventing the wheel there at all, you know, but that's absolutely fine. You know, not everything has got to be that. And I just really enjoyed doing it, you know, and I wasn't intending, I sat down to write an album or anything like that at all. It was really a result. Actually, I'll tell you what it was. I wrote the score for a film, movie, 2 years ago. And that was a real struggle for me because, you know, when electronic producers get asked to score films, it's usually like a kind of sci-fi or kind of a dark kind of thing. And I was scoring a comedy.
Oh,
and it was
right.
Very, very difficult to do. It really was. I mean, what it turned out as, it was great. It was, looking back at it, it was a great process. It was really a huge amount, but it was tough, right? And I had numerous disagreements with the director about stylistic, you know, kind of like the beats of certain scenes that he wanted done in a certain way. I was like, no, it can't be like. So I was doing my usual arrogant control freak thing, which was not helpful at all. But I have to, you know, have to say, it turned out fine. But at the end of that process, I was like, right, what's the furthest away that I can get from scoring a modern comedy flick? And writing old school hardcore was essentially what I alighted on. And like I said, it was just a lot of fun, really. And I just churned out so many of those tunes. And so we've done 2 12s. And then the mixtape thing. So it was like, I don't know, it's 20 odd tracks or something in total that I actually finished, but there must have been another 20 or 30 that I kind of got quite far down the road with. So it was just, yeah, like I said, it was just fun. And sometimes that's the best way. I mean, I should say that sometimes having fun in the studio is not a good thing. Sometimes it can be like, you know, like I said, like more on that kind of self-indulgent thing. What is enjoyable to do isn't always enjoyable to listen to. But I think in this case, the two things coalesced happily.
I mean, I definitely feel that from listening to it, the fun of it. And was that also the idea of it being a mixtape rather than being kind of classified as an album, that it's not part of like the sort of general lineage of what you're doing? It's a piece of fun.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reason why I wanted to call it a mixtape, because I mean, the albums that I've done previously, I have sat down to write a, you know, album in, you know, capital letters. So and it wasn't like that at all, you know. And I'm pretty happy with the way my album projects turned out, and I can look at them. I mean, I haven't actually released one for a long time now, but the kind of body of work that's there as my album projects is something that I want to say proud of, but like, you know, I'm not completely comfortable with using that word.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
But with this, it was very obviously different, you know? So it had to be something, you know, it had to be sort of described in a different kind of a way. And, you know, it is literally a mixtape. You know, like it, you can listen to it start to finish. There's no gaps. And it just like, you know, it's supposed to be like, well, I mean, the way I put the final thing together was almost like one of those tape packs you got from, you know, raves back in the day. So that's kind of the general vibe of it, you know? So yeah,
it's funny how, you know, I love those old tapes. I used to go to the local market, and every Sunday there'd be a fresh bunch of these tapes, you know, and also like the rave artwork as well. It's funny how it's become like part of history now, isn't it? And I mean, I feel like we're in a roughly similar age bracket, you know. And I was wanted to know, like, did you have like really early experiences with electronic music or just music in general, like that kind of really informed you stepping into doing this for a living?
Yeah. So my first memory, as it were, of electronic stuff, or certainly stuff which is music, which would have been played at raves. I was on a school like trip, like a week away with school kind of thing. And it was our year, and there was the year above were there as well. One of the kids from the year above had one of those tapes from one of those tape packs. And it would have been, I guess, it would have been that kind of era. So like 92. So I mean, I was born in 79. So I was like 12 or 13 in 92. So, and it was that music basically. And I remember it just being completely captivated immediately by the helium vocals, especially, you know, those little kind of like vocal hooks with the stuff like that. And, you know, the beats. And I just thought it was so cool immediately. But then, you know, it didn't have any direct link to it until a couple of years later. I mean, I started going out to clubs when I was, I guess, like just turned 15 or that, or, you know, that sort of, 94, 95, it would have been, maybe end of 94. And, you know, went to a whole load of those early, also, I guess it's sort of like the late period of early jungle, if you see what I mean. And just loved it. But also went to techno stuff and was just like not very picky really about the kind of music that I was going to go raving to. And, you know, did a whole load of drugs as well, which obviously helps. And, you know, just really, just kind of embraced the whole thing. Just had, you know, so much fun with it. And it was, I feel extremely fortunate to have been living in London during that period, really, because it was like, I mean, you could say like maybe it would have been, you know, 3 or 4 years earlier would have been the real sweet spot. But I mean, you know, the mid-90s were great, absolutely great in terms of the stuff that was on offer in London, the kind of variety of it, and just the ability to get into the clubs as well if you wanted to, if you're, you know, get yourself a fake ID and you can get in. And, you know, it was just without, you know, it's very easy to be starry-eyed about it, but it genuinely was pretty amazing. And it's kind of weird to think that now, and that was also the time that Britpop was going on. And obviously Britpop was heavily referencing the 60s, and where we are now I think is basically in time, like in relational time, similar periods to, you know, the mid-90s now versus the 60s then. And I kind of see like people like Fred Again are sort of Britpop artists of today, basically.
Yeah.
And which is fine, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But it's weird being able to see it in its historical perspective, you know, having, because I was quite into some of the Britpop bands. And I obviously knew, you know, I knew the Beatles and I knew the kind of historical context of the music. But when you have, when you've been there, it's very different, right? When you can actually remember the stuff firsthand that, that the new stuff is referencing, is a bit of a, it's a bit of a strange sensation, to be honest. But yeah, I mean, just generally speaking, like the early experience that I had were just uniformly positive, basically. Even at those raves, which were a bit dangerous, and you know, there were some, you know, fights going on and whatever, that was part of the fun to me. You know, it was like that, that sense of danger was absolutely part of the attraction to the whole thing. It really felt like you were in something, you know, that mattered, you know. And you know, and culture, real culture, you know. So yeah, it was great. It's awesome.
That's amazing. I love those reflections. It's interesting what you're saying about the danger as well, because I mean, obviously I only know what is around me and the experiences of people I know and myself, but I feel that in the 90s, like I love the way you're describing the 90s, there was this huge sense of optimism. You know, you had Britpop as well, and like all of these very fresh scenes of, you know, electronic music was still very, very new in reaching people on dance floors. But there was this sort of sense of, like, people, I don't know if you remember this or if it's the same for you, but I feel like people are a lot nicer to each other now than they were in the 90s. Like, it was maybe because of like lad culture or whatever, but I remember like me and my friends were all just really horrible to each other and horrible to everyone. You know what I mean? You know, and there was this sense of sort of violence when you'd go to clubs as well. You know, did you sort of feel that yourself?
I see what you're referring to. Yeah, I can recognize that as something which is there has been a change, yeah, in the way that people act. I mean, I'm not sure it's necessarily entirely a good thing though. To be honest.
In what way?
I think that the way people are nice to each other now is largely superficial,
right?
And you know, like I said, that sense of danger that I'm referring to is not something that I just felt in the 90s, actually. I've spoken a good few times, actually, about feeling a similar sort of thing the first time I went to Berghain.
Yeah.
And it's, in fact, I think we talked about this on, my show. Yeah. And it's not necessarily, a feeling of like physical, like impending violence. It's not necessarily that. I think it's more just a sense of being out of your comfort zone, I suppose. But then also like the sensation that, you know, anything can happen in this situation. And I think maybe what the way I feel about the equivalent stuff now is that I don't have that impression that anything could happen at all. It feels very, if comparatively speaking anyway, it feels very sterile and it feels like a bit too stage managed. And I think you lose something. Like when you lose that sense of unpredictability and that sense that, you know, danger is like, you know, the word danger kind of implies, like I said, a sense of like physical jeopardy. It's not necessarily just that, but the fact that, like I said, everything is in play does imply that too, you know? So I don't know. I'm on the side of the fence that I think safety is taken a bit too seriously these days. I think there should be a bit more, I think people should have a little more leeway to, you know, to do what they feel without having a, you know, the strong arm of the law, whether it's literally the law or otherwise, hanging over them, you know?
I mean, I 100% agree with you, to be honest. I mean, obviously, you know, this is quite a precarious thing to sort of say, but, you know, I definitely feel like even things like smoking, you know, I feel like I love going.
100% agree with that. Yeah.
Fucking hell. Going to a bar in Berlin and being able to have a cigarette is like, I don't like being shunted outside when I go back to London or most other cities. And it just feels like a little bit like, yeah, I know like cigarettes are really dangerous, but like, so what? So's everything. You know? There's so many things in life that are dangerous that are still perhaps, you know, we're still encouraged to partake in.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a smoker, but I really think you should be able to smoke in bars and clubs. I genuinely do. And I think, you know, the smoking ban, when it came in the UK, did an unbelievable damage to the club scene and disproportionately to small venues. It really did. It was extremely damaging to the culture. Mm. And it's telling, I think, that, you know, in Germany, because it's supposed to be an EU-wide law, right? It's supposed to be a directive. And Germany just ignored it, basically, until very recently, which is kind of crazy. But, I mean, I do think that having those sorts of regulations, and it's very easy to get into a sort of party political partisan kind of debate here. But I genuinely think that there should be less done by government. And that really does sound like a particular thing, doesn't it? But I genuinely believe it to be true. I think particularly in like small venues, you know, I can understand why, you know, I can understand there being a law against smoking in the workplace, quote unquote, and in offices and all that kind of stuff. That's fine. That makes sense. But I feel like there should be some reasonable opt-out available for areas where, you know, areas which are kind of culturally fragile potentially. And that's what we did find out, you know, by that smoking ban, like that actually the culture of underground music in the UK was pretty fragile and was really badly damaged, I think, by the smoking ban. And obviously, you know, it's kind of reset itself now, and you know, everyone going out now, lot by and large, don't remember a time when there was smoking, or the majority of the audience anyway, don't remember a time when there was smoking. But, you know, I think that behavior changed in a long-term way with that. And those behaviors are the behaviors that are observable now, you know? So it's not like, it just kind of resets and then you kind of go back to the old ways just without smoking. That's not actually what's happened at all, you know? So I don't know, what is the status in Berlin now? Because the last time I went to Berlin, it was really being enforced, but then I heard again that it was a bit of a kind of haphazard thing. So what's the deal right now in Berlin?
I think it's a bit haphazard, really. I've been to venues where you can't smoke, you have to go outside. Like the venue About Blank, last time I went, it was no smoking inside. But most places seems to be like, you know, people do smoke. I really love what you're saying there, actually. I remember like when the smoking ban came in the UK, I think it was 2007, I went to go and see a local band play, and poor band, like everyone was just outside smoking cigarettes, you know, just the whole, including myself. And I think, so it does, you do sort of lose that sense of fluidity, you know, and it becomes, I wonder if there's something that's connected with that and the fact of like smartphone culture, that we've become so, we can pick and choose the experiences we want and duck in and duck out. And do you feel like that we do sort of pick and choose our experiences so much? And that goes down from everything from like ordering food on Deliveroo whenever we want to, like knowing what time the DJs are playing on a big night. Do you feel like we miss out something in the amount of choice and options that are kind of presented to us now?
Yeah, absolutely. Just one more thing on smoking.
Yeah.
I think that cigarette smoke in a venue adds a huge amount of atmosphere. Yeah. And when you go to like particularly bigger venues now, when I walk into an arena sized venue or even a theater, they seem unbelievably sterile. I mean, that's a word I used before, but I think it's the right word to use. Like going into the O2 or somewhere like that, it really is like being in a shopping mall.
Yeah.
And that is I think something that was mitigated in the old days, to put it
it's like
slightly uncomfortably. Like
Photoshop, isn't it? It's having like a necessary filter over a venue to sort of go, okay, like, you know, it's like watching a film that hasn't been kind of color graded or something.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah, exactly what it is. And it's difficult. I mean, again, like the majority of the audience now don't have that prior reference, so they don't care about that. But for, you know, old people, it's unavoidable. Like you can't unsee it. Anyway, your question about smartphones and kind of on-demand culture, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I think, again, It's difficult to be, I mean, yes, it's bad, like unambiguously bad, I think. Like, I mean, there's no getting around that. But I think that equally, there's no going back. So I think a more productive way of thinking about it, or what more productive way of looking at it, would be to ask how to mitigate that, you know, how to improve the experience. And I mean, it's a question that's come up indirectly a lot on my show, and there doesn't seem to be a huge amount of ideas or good ideas out there for how to appreciably improve things. I don't know. I mean, it's like, I think it's difficult to avoid the conclusion that it's fundamentally incompatible with club culture as it was previously known anyway. But I think also, I mean a big development in the last 20 years or so has been just the popularity of big live events, you know. The Taylor Swift tour is you know the best example of it. Like, you know, she's literally a billionaire now off the back of that tour. Like, it's like a global phenomenon. It really is. Like, I mean, she's being lobbied by national governments to do shows in their country because there's a tangible economic benefit when she puts on a show in a city. It's crazy. Like, I mean, the difference it's made to it's made real palpable difference to cities in the United States, you know. Like, it's really incredible. And, you know, that shows there's a real appetite for people to go out and experience stuff, right? But they're just experiencing it in a slightly different way than they were previously. And I think there is a danger of kind of, you know, sort of devaluing, I suppose, the current method of enjoying something, right? And I think that's something that like every generation seeks to look down on the previous one, right? I mean, that's just something that happens naturally. And you've got to be careful about that, you know. So if stuff is happening which seems to be good, which is to say that people really like it, which obviously is happening, you know, then should we really be that cynical about it? I don't know. I mean, it's very easy to be cynical about it, absolutely. But I try to keep my mind open. But just in the case of in the instance of the culture in quotation marks, like you know, club culture, dark rooms, open ended, you know, run times, you know, not too much interaction going on other than dancing. Like, yeah, I'd struggle to see how this really fits in a significant way. I mean, obviously it's going to be there and it's going to endure to some extent, but I mean, I think there will need to be another turning of the wheel before that part of it anyway, the kind of small venue underground clubs, before that side of the culture really picks up some steam again, because at the moment it's not in a great place, you know. Big events are doing great, festivals are doing great, but small venues, small clubs are not at all. And I think it's a real shame, because, you know, but those venues are really the most important bit, I think, of it.
I mean, that's the breeding ground of where people will be in the bigger places, will be hearing things in a few years' time, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, certainly it used to be anyway. I think the breeding ground now actually is TikTok and Instagram, you know? And, you know, and the way those then feed into, you know, stuff like radio and then stuff like Boiler Room streams. And, you know, it's a different ecosystem, which I think probably produces a slightly different kind of music. There's definitely a different style of DJing, different style of kind of artists, image, just say that image is a lot more important. And that's just where we are, you know. That's just a technological progression, which is to say, not necessarily meaning that in a positive sense, but, you know, it's a development, and you have to accept it, I suppose, and make the best of it as much as you can.
I think so, definitely. I think it's one of the benefits we have of age, isn't it? Is that we have the option of being a grumpy bastard, which we all have in us, but we also have the option of balancing that out with how we go into the world with it. And that's something that you definitely seem to do. It's like sort of hit the balance, you know, have the perspective of where you've come from, but the, you know, being open to the changes, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, being new definitely isn't necessarily being better. Like that's just not right at all. Like, you know, there always has to be a quality test which has to be met, right? So just because something is the new thing, the cool thing, you know, like quite often it's not good, right? So, but I mean, and so the older you are, the more difficult it is to say that, right? Basically, because the reactive, the instinctive reaction of so many older people is just to be dismissive because it's not what they know, right? I mean, that's completely understandable and is what people, largely speaking, do. So you've got to keep an eye on that. But also, you can't be, you know, you can't let that drive your opinion to such an extent that you lose sight of what's good. You know,
yeah.
Because I think quite a lot of people do that, kind of swing back too hard the other way and just you know, embrace new developments for the sake of them being new, right? Because I mean, yeah, quite often they're not good, right? So yeah, you know, but yeah, I mean, in answer to your question, I do, I suppose, try. I mean, I basically just try and keep an eye on it. You know, I try and keep an eye on my prejudices and kind of try and keep an eye on my, yeah, natural grumpy old man state in gradually encroaching more and more, right? Which happens to everyone, right?
Yeah. I mean, I love what you're saying there about the kind of keeping an eye, or like you can't like everything. Otherwise, it's like a little bit like the kind of middle-aged dude that buys a leather jacket and suddenly gets like a 19-year-old girlfriend, isn't it? It's like, just like, you know, I mean, but then it's like on the opposite end, you had someone like John Peel who seemed to navigate that.
Well, I think John Peel's bullshit. Yeah, I think John Peel's, you know, bullshit detector and his kind of, you know, taste was impeccable, you know? So, you know, he didn't play just any new shit. He would play good new stuff. And, you know, that's a rare skill to be able to maintain that into sort of middle age. Like, not a lot of people have it. People get very stuck in their ways, which is, you know, which is understandable. There's nothing wrong with that per se. You shouldn't beat up on people for that. But equally speaking, if you're working in culture or the arts or whatever, then you've really got to make sure that doesn't take over your appreciation of art, basically, or of any kind of, like, you know, creative stuff which is going on at a given moment. Like, you've got to be able to appraise it honestly. You know, I think that's an important thing. It's like being able to appraise something in a way which is true to your experience, you know, drawing on your experience. That is the one thing about getting old, which is undeniably good, is that you know more shit, you know, you're bringing more to the table in terms of that stuff. But it's like, you've got to let that experience shut, you know, you've got to let that come through rather than have it be clouded by your prejudices and bitterness about being older than the people that you're trying to praise.
Definitely. Do you have like any practices that help you with this, or with your kind of creative process generally?
I mean, I think having a DJ set that you've got to maintain really helps. Generally speaking, I think like being forced to listen to new music for that reason, if no other reason, just that, like, it really is useful for, you know, keeping up with what's happening, but also being forced to figure out if you like it or not, like really like it. Because I mean, if you're a proper DJ, then you won't play anything you don't like, but you've got to, again, if you're a proper DJ, you've got to keep playing new stuff, right? So you need to find the stuff out there that you're into. And that can be difficult, but it does force you to think in that kind of a way. Absolutely. And that's a useful kind of mechanism to have to go through on a regular basis. Certainly. I think maintaining my DJ sets probably has been the single most important thing over the years for forcing me to put aside my prejudices, or the natural prejudices which build up over time, and just keep on top of developments and, you know, praise them in a kind of honest way, the way that I was, you know, trying to describe.
Yeah, I guess it's like keeping up with a DJ set, with your DJ set and how it evolves is a way of, you know, it's almost like a calendar, isn't it? You know, it's like November is what is coming out in November, what you're available to see in November. So you are keeping up with times in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just the necessity to go through your promos, listen to the new releases, you know, and the process of doing that it naturally develops, you know. So you become familiar with the new labels which are emerging, the new artists, and like you get your new favorites, and over the course of a number of years you kind of realize that there's these kind of ebbs and flows to everything, and people come and go, and like, you know, it's never not exciting when you discover someone new who's doing really exciting stuff. I mean, that's a feeling which doesn't go away, you know, doesn't get old. And the feeling of playing a new record which is really exciting is something which doesn't go away either. You know, just putting that track on and it's like, wow, okay, this is something new, which is doing something different. I mean, I think those moments aren't, well, certainly the sensation of hearing something absolutely new is very few and far between these days, but it doesn't have to be that at all. It can just be a track which is just exciting. It's an exciting record, you know, a really well put together, a real well realized dance track. I mean, those are joyous things, right? You know, they really are. So, you know, and that, like I said, doesn't get old.
Yeah. And I was sat in a cafe in Neukölln earlier on, and I went back and listened to A Mutual Antipathy, which I haven't listened to for quite a while. And it's interesting because I think at the time it came out in 2008, and you were living in Berlin at the time.
Yeah, I wouldn't call that a joyous dance record, but
no, it's definitely not. But I feel like it's funny because I remember at the time, you know, it was talked about in the UK press anyway, at least in the context of dubstep and UK bass. Yeah, yeah. But listening to it in Neukölln, it sounded to me more like just something that felt built in atmosphere, really. What was going on with you at the time that made, you know, you made this kind of such a sort of like heavy but also purely electronic piece of music?
Yeah, I mean, it's the right place to listen to it, actually, Neukölln, because it was the first thing I did when I moved to Berlin was write those tunes. It was like the 3 or 4 months after I arrived. At the end of, I think I arrived in September 2007, and the record was done by the end of January. So, I mean, I was living in Friedrichshain at the time, but Friedrichshain was a different place to how it is now. And, you know, it was a reflection of the surroundings, I guess. Because, I mean, you know, Berlin's can be a very bleak kind of a place, particularly in the winter. And that record sounds like it was pretty bleak, isn't it? Really,
I'm just really drawn to bleakness that I don't notice it. Like I was always sort of more Radiohead than anything else, really. Right. So that's always been sort of an attraction to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite. Yeah, it's evocative. I mean, I went back and listened to it not that long ago. It was actually, we did a 10-year thing, but that was 5 years ago now. So, I was pleasantly surprised because I didn't really listen to it at all in that kind of decade after it came out. And I remember being quite pleasantly surprised at how good it sounded for a start, because I mean, it's very, you know, I'm a completely self-taught engineer and producer, and I think I'm quite good at it now, but I was definitely not that good at it, technically speaking, anyway, back then. But that's okay, because the beauty of sound engineering is that you can luck your way into stuff, and if you can trust your ears and your ears are good, then you can deliver results without a huge amount of technical knowledge. But I mean, just in terms of the vibe of it, yeah, the mood of it, I mean, it really is, it's gray sounding, and it's really it's got that, I guess, a kind of that post-industrial decay kind of dripping out of it. And that's certainly what I took from listening to it again anyway, and that's absolutely what Berlin was like then. I mean, it's still like that a bit now, but it was much more like that then. And you know, I think in hindsight I was just making what was around me. I mean, I'd been to Berlin before, but only a couple of times just to DJ, you know, so I hadn't spent a lot of time in the city. So I had a few mates there before I moved, so I was able to had a bit of, you know, a bit of a social group, so, you know, was able just to go out and kind of soak it up a bit. And it was very different to London, certainly. I mean, it was certainly London in the 2000s, it was very different, but it was also very different to London had been, you know, when I first started going out. The parties were more reminiscent of that than they were of the parties in mid 2000s. London, but the vibe in the city and the kind of general surroundings couldn't have been any different. And that's, you know, not surprising because, you know, when the wall came down, the place was, you know, needed to be rebuilt, you know, from the ground up in places. So I know you obviously, you know that you've written about it, but I mean, the album as a whole, I think, yeah, just reflects that really. But like I said, not a happy dance record. In fact, when I remember one of the best bits of DJ feedback from, you know, promo feedback that I ever got was from the Adrenaline, that track, which is obviously a happy dance record. And someone left, Scuba's getting laid. that was his feedback. And if they listen to Mutual Antipathy, they probably think I wasn't getting laid that much. It's probably accurate to be honest.
Oh my God, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. I think the first time I DJed in Berlin was in this bar, and our owner came up to me looking really concerned, and he just said, play darker. And I just thought, like, oh my God, after 10 years of DJing in London, that was just like Nirvana for me to hear, really.
Right, yeah, okay.
And like, you bought, so then round about this time, the Substance night, you bought this night Substance to Berghain. And, you know, what was kind of like the importance for you of, you know, because again, taking like UK sounds and dubstep and all of these elements into Berghain, how did you see that fusing? What was it like? I mean, this was before my jumping on time into Berlin. So I'm kind of just listening to your words, kind of building up a picture of what it was like as well.
Yeah. So, you know, myself and the guy who I ran the party with, is called Paul Fowler, who was my, also my booking agent at the time, actually the first booking agent I ever had. One of the, you know, the one of the kind of people I became good friends with when I moved over from London. We decided that we wanted to do a night and we're looking for a venue for it. So Berghain was not, you know, Berghain obviously just seemed like, it wasn't in the conversation because no one does nights at Berghain really. Certainly not dubstep nights anyway. And coincidentally, the other pool. Actually, that here's another pool. That's
three pools. That's amazing.
Yeah, right. So he bumped into one of the guys from the back office at Berghain. I think it was an Ortega gig in the city. And kind of drunkenly pitched him a dubstep night at Berghain. I mean, very drunkenly, just a complete speculative, you know, move. And they went for it. And I, you know, I'd been there as a punter a couple of times. I mean, not loads, but I'd certainly been there. And I'd also been turned away from there as well. And, you know, the idea of doing a night there was just, it was a bit confusing, to be honest. Because, I mean, we were planning to do stuff which was not like, you know, dubstep has had at that point, this is 2000. So the first Substance Party was July 2008. So this would have been, the conversations would have been kind of early 2008. And dubstep by that point was pretty popular globally. You know, it had not gone full kind of Skrillex, but like certainly there was real appetite in Europe. I mean, in the UK, it was enormous. There was appetite for it in Europe. There was certainly there was a big night I remember in Antwerp, I believe it was, like a fucking huge, like thousands of people turning up kind of thing. And I think that basically the places where drum and bass was big in Europe, dubstep was catching on fast, and there was an audience emerging for it pretty fast in the States too. So it was kind of the coming storm, right, of electronic music. And you know, The music had already gone in a direction which I was not at all happy with. And that was part of my motivation for moving to Berlin in the first place. I found myself quite disconnected from the London scene musically. And what we wanted to do was dubstep, but not dubstep, basically. We wanted to do a big dubstep night, which reflected the side of the music which wasn't being reflected in the big nights, you know, and then the big kind of like high profile things. So we wanted to do something big, but like being able to do it at Berghain was just a, you know, wow, fuck. It's because, you know, I didn't fully appreciate it at the time, but the, you know, the publicity that comes with that and the attention that comes with Berghain, and it wasn't then what it is now, but it certainly was people knew about it, absolutely, and certainly people in the press knew about it. And for them to get us to do what we did there was incredible for us. But actually, I mean, looking back at it now, I think it probably helped them as well in terms of their perception. You know, I think it widened the perception of Berghain, and it kind of like really established in people's minds that they weren't just this kind of like techno monolith, which should, you know, which was the kind of, I guess, image which was being built up around the venue. And, you know, the first night was, I mean, it was amazing, but it was tough and it was nerve wracking. And looking back on it now, it was, it was an unforgettable experience for sure, but it was by no means a foregone conclusion that it was going to be successful. I mean, that's something important to, you know, to emphasize. Like bass music, quote unquote, which is to say, like, you know, drum and bass and, you know, anything which is not 4/4 had been popular in Berlin, but actually it was at a really low ebb. Like Watergate did a really long running drum and bass night, and there was other stuff going on, but it really got crowded out by Minimal, I think, in 2006 and 2007. So the kind of environment we were starting out in was really, well, it really felt monocultural musically. You can hear my cat trying to kind of get into the room. I've had to lock him out. He's going crazy.
Right. I'm all fine for a bit of cat on the microphone. It's totally fine.
No, I can't let him in. He's farted out. Anyway, it really felt monocultural in the city musically. So it was a big risk for them and for us, you know. And I'd be lying if I said it was a massive roadblock on the first night. It was busy, but it wasn't like a total. I mean, we didn't sell tickets. Well, you weren't allowed to sell tickets at Berghain.
Yeah.
They need to reserve the right to not let most of the people in. So it was busy, but it wasn't crazy. But it was enough to keep going. And like, I think it probably got really good. I think when around 2000, so we did it 5 years. So the last one was in July 2013. So I think like end of 2009. To the end of 2011, those years were just amazing for it, like really, really great. And you know, those were the peak years for that kind of music as well. Because I mean, eventually, what happened with it is that the music kind of moved on, and that's why we stopped doing it in the end. Because I mean, to me, that kind of music had stopped being exciting, and it had stopped really happening. So we had to move on. But that kind of period, so like 2009, 2011, those kind of 3 years. It was great, and it was unlike anything else, really, before or since, I have to say, musically, because it didn't really get replaced by anything. I mean, I know there's stuff which goes on now, but it's a very different thing, even if the music is ostensibly kind of a similar thing. Like, you know, it was what we were doing there was a real, it was a kind of unique expression of what was a really exciting cultural movement at the time. And it was a great thing to do and a great thing to be a part of, and it was awesome, but it was very much of the moment, I think, you know.
Yeah That's amazing that you captured that at that time. Because there is this kind of eclecticism to your, if you kind of zoom out at your career, that, you know, I don't like using the word career, but, you know, for the better, like a better word, career, there is this kind of grand eclecticism going on. But when you zoom in, like every project you do, you sort of do treat with a kind of purism to it. And I mean, there's always these sort of discussions in DJ discourse and electronic music discourse about like eclecticism and if it's a good thing or not versus purity. And how do you feel about that? Do you know, because obviously like eclecticism can have a dirty name as well. It can be kind of sort of seen as being this jack of all trades kind of thing, you know. Where do you sort of fit on that?
Yeah, I'm generally very suspicious of purism in music. I think it's largely counterproductive. I think it's largely the expression of people's close-mindedness, actually, usually. And also kind of virtue signaling as well, I think, particularly in kind of dance music genres, but actually, I mean, music genres, generally speaking. I mean, you get these kind of self-styled gatekeepers of what is and isn't acceptable in any given genre. And it's totally ridiculous and completely, I mean, yeah. I mean, usually, like I said, perpetrated by people who really should know better, but are kind of expressing their, probably their own insecurities, actually, in trying to control other people. But I mean, having said that, I do think that culture should be respected. And when culture emerges, you've got to understand it. You've got to incumbent upon you if you're going to participate to really understand what's going on in it. And then, you know, you can make your own decisions about what you want to engage with and what you don't want to engage with. And that in itself causes problems for people, you know, because people like to, well, dance fans especially, let's just say music fans, I think it's true across the board. Music fans like to engage with people who they consider to be authentic in massive quotation marks.
Mm.
And if you're chopping and changing, then it's very easy for people to get the idea or get the wrong impression or maybe it's the right impression actually, that you're not taking things as seriously as they want you to take them, you know? Mm. So I mean, I totally understand that. And actually, you know, I'm guilty of it too, certainly. As a music fan, you know, I like my bands to be, you know, I like them to stay in one lane, put it that way. And that I know from being on the other side of the fence, that's extremely frustrating as an artist. And you know, yeah. I've confounded people over the years by not doing my different, you know, kinds of music under different names and, you know, starting different projects for different kinds of music. And in hindsight, maybe that would have been a better idea. But equally, I mean, that was completely intentional because I saw myself as being, and generally speaking, see myself as doing basically the same thing, but just with a slightly different angle, you know. And if that's expressed in a different musical genre, and sometimes it's a musical genre which is so close to the other genre which they're angry about, is, you know, is almost meaningless. Or certainly to the uninitiated person, it would be, you know, almost indistinguishable. Like I find that kind of thing frustrating, and I would consider creating different projects and creating different identities to fit that stuff. I would consider that to be inauthentic, to be honest. So I kind of like you know, take it the other way. So I don't know. I mean, I think there is room for taking things really seriously culturally and you know, being aware of, you know, the minutiae, you know, and being aware of how seriously people take things. That's absolutely legitimate, totally. But then I don't think you can, you know, allow yourself to be dictated to by those people and by those kind of norms too closely, I guess.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, I mean, I feel like, you know, it is art, and I do understand like why you have chefs that feel like the only way you can make a lasagna is to use these certain ingredients, and if you start changing it, it's not lasagna anymore, you know, that's fine. But you know, I feel like, you know, it's an artist's, part of an artist's journey to kind of fuck things up in their own way as well.
Yeah, I mean, the best one I ever heard was someone saying, I can't remember who it was, I think I can, but I won't mention his name. Someone saying, if you've got a kick or a clap, sorry, if you've got a snare or a clap on the 2 and 4 of a tune, then it can't be techno. Which is absolutely fucking ludicrous.
Yeah, yeah.
But in some respects, I completely respect that. You know, okay. If that's how we're going on, then yeah, that's cool, you know? And you know, if thrash metal has to be 180 BPM or whatever, you know what I mean, that's, or drum and bass has to be, you know, 170 or 175, whatever it is, you know, I like that stuff. I mean, of course, it's constricting if you take it too seriously, but I love the fact that those things exist. You know, I love that people take it that seriously. I think it's awesome. And yeah, absolutely. In the case of the example of food, those Italians who literally go fucking crazy if you put cream in a carbonara, which, by the way, I completely agree with. Like, you should not put cream in a carbonara. But the Italians that literally like want to take up arms against people, I fucking love that they're so invested in that shit. You know, this is great to me. It's absolutely great. And that is culture. People being that invested in stuff is culture. You know, and you can tell the strength of something by the fact that people get so angry. You know, so outraged. Which is, it's fine. It's fine. But like, you can't, you know, I think, I mean, there are examples of musicians who use those parameters as something really creative. Well, use those parameters in a really creative way. You know, I think there are people who make techno or who make drum and bass or whatever who just do that, and they it's like those, you know, it's like Japanese sushi chefs or, you know, the Japanese in just about any discipline, to be honest, who just spend decades of their life refining something and refining something and refining something. And I think there are producers like that. There are and particularly a genre like techno, I think, really lends itself to that kind of thing, and also drum and bass. And that's great. That's completely legitimate as a way of working as a musician. You know, I've got no problem with that at all. But it's not for everyone, you know? And yeah. I guess if I've got a problem with any of it, it's when people start prescribing the work of other people who aren't like that, you know? That's the only problem I have with the whole thing, really. But as a general, you know, thing that happens, I'm, you know, be as militant as you want.
Yeah.
About the musical parameters which make up a musical genre. That's totally fine.
Totally. I think it's we need the whole ecosystem, don't we? We need a whole people from all different perspectives coming at it, and then out of that you get like people that protect the traditions, like that lasagna, that carbonara, so you know, because it has cultural worth and it has history. But then you also have the people that innovate and fuck up with it, because you know that's where the future is as well, and it's somehow we just have to fit in, you know, take what we want out of it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where gatekeeping can be good.
Yeah.
And can be necessary and can really add a lot, you know, to the whole thing. Because, I mean, obviously, gatekeepers have got a bit of a bad rep these days, but I think they, you know, fill a really important function in the kind of development of anything. But I think, particularly in culture and the arts, you know, I think it, in the way that you describe in the kind of the preservation of stuff, but also in, you know, go back to what we were saying about, you know, quality being, yeah, newness is not an indicator of quality. Like, I mean, there's got to be someone of authority who's able to say that, right? Like, there's nothing bad about that. Obviously, it can go too far. Anything can go too far.
Yeah.
But I really think that having some sort of respected authority in any kind of thing, and it can't be, you know, all powerful, but some kind of yardstick which people can look to, I think is really, really useful, really important.
Yeah. And finally, how do you look back on your creative life? What would you go back and tell, like, you know, 15-year-old you?
Stay off Twitter. Probably.
Yeah.
Talk less, generally. Talk less. I think maybe it's a bit different now. And maybe the expectations are slightly different now. But I think that the more mystery you can retain about yourself, generally speaking, the better. And nothing removes mystery like voicing an opinion. I do think that's still true, actually. I think the more, and I think there's a couple of different advantages to it. First of all, I mean, just what I've just said about, you know, just having a kind of air of unpredictability and an air of mystery around yourself can be really evocative to people. But also, it enables people to map themselves onto you. And that's a really cynical way of looking at it, in a kind of marketing kind of a sense. But I think it's really valuable, you know. I think it really enables people to engage with your whatever kind of creative stuff you're making, whether it's music or art or film or whatever. If they don't know your political stance or political opinion or whatever it is, they can approach it in a way which is much more neutral, I think, and they can map on whatever they want to map on to it, you know. And I think that's, if I was going to, you know, if I had the choice, like, I would rather be in that position than a kind of overtly political position in terms of, like, you know, what people knew about me. That's a really bad way of putting it, but you know what I mean? Now, there are obviously examples of people who are overtly political and nakedly political, and that's part of the message, absolutely. And you know, there's you know, bands that I love, like someone like, I don't know, who's a good example? Just to pluck a really obvious one, Rage Against the Machine. Like everyone knew where they stood, right? And it's in the lyrics, but it's not just in the lyrics. It's like everything about
it's in
the
their
band.
Blood. It's the whole makeup of the band, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, who's the director I'm trying to think of? Ken Loach.
Ken Loach. Fugazi. That's another one.
Yeah, exactly. You know, those people who, what they make is deeply connected to their publicly stated personal beliefs, right? So it can absolutely work, but if I was going to have the choice, if I was going to tell myself what to do, I would say just keep everything private, and then people can, you know, bring to it whatever they want to bring to it. And I think that would be my preference now. So, but generally speaking, that would be my advice to anyone starting any kind of creative or artistic or whatever kind of career. Just say as little as possible, basically. At the end of an hour long podcast.
Well, you know, it's always a bit of this and that, isn't it, though? But yeah, no, totally get you on that. That's brilliant. Paul, thank you so much for giving me your time today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on, man.
Right, so that was me, Paul Hamford, talking with Scuba, aka Paul Rose, for Lost and Sound podcast. And we had that conversation right at the beginning of November 2023. Scuba's digital underground mixtape is out 10th of November. Well worth a listen. Not a diving podcast. His podcast is out weekly. Again, subscribe to it. Check it out. Subscribe to it wherever you get your podcast. It's really, really, really well worth a listen. I really enjoyed being a guest on his show the other month, and I really enjoyed having the chairs reversed and him coming on my show. I really enjoyed that chat. Thank you so much, Paul. Audio Technica are the sponsors of this show. Global but still family-run company that make headphones, turntables, cartridges, microphones, studio quality yet affordable products, because they believe that high-quality audio should be accessible to all. I'm right now wearing a pair of their headphones. I'm in Cottbusser Tour in Berlin, and it's really cold, but these headphones, not only am I able to listen to myself talk to you, but they're keeping me kind of warm as well. Yes, my book, Coming to Berlin, is available in all good bookshops or via Velocity Press, the publisher's website. And I'd like to shout out, as I always do, to Thomas Giddens, who does the music you hear at the beginning, at the end of every episode of Lost and Sound. And I had a little while ago, I had a little sneak peek of some music that he's been working on for a project that where details will be revealed very soon. And it's really, 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 really good. But yeah, that's it for today. Really hope you enjoyed that chat. I hope you're taking really good care of yourself. I hope you're having a really lovely day, and I'll chat to you soon.